from WBUR Boston and NPR. I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. The news out of Fallujah and Ramadi, Iraq's Anbar province, in recent days has sounded back to the future, and not in a good way. Al-Qaeda back in the streets, in charge, years after U.S. troops fought and died there, and a region maybe coming undone. This hour On Point, back to Fallujah and a region in trouble. Joining us first today from Baghdad is Sawdad Al-Sahi, Reuters Iraq correspondent. Sawdad, thank you very much for being with us. Who are these jihadi militants who have moved into Fallujah and Ramadi, Sawdad?
Thank you for you to host me in your show.
You're quite welcome.
Thank you very much. Actually, we are facing different situations in Ramadi and Fallujah, in whole Anbar this time, as we have jihadist militants from Islamic State of Iraq and the Levant. We have tribal fighters. And at Fallujah, we have small groups from other Sunni insurgency, like Naqsha Bandiya, Kata'ib Thawrat al-Ashreen, and other small groups.
So
who were operating in different places outside Anbar, but they joined the militants in Anbar, in Fallujah, last few days.
Do we know how many of these militants came across the border from Syria's fight, Sawdad?
Actually, we cannot say specifically they just came last few days. As this part of the of Iraq has witnessed. Many operations or many attacks, significant attacks during the last few weeks of the Islamic State of Iraq and the Levant was trying to create its own state on the ground this time by launching high-profile attacks on the border towns which belong to Anbar province. We have no idea how many specifically, but we are talking about hundreds of high-profile, well-trained militants who crossed the border from Syria and into Syria.
Sawdad, we've seen video images of Iraqi central authority, Iraqi army troops moving toward Fallujah and Ramadi, maybe surrounding them. What's the status at this time? Have they begun a full-scale effort to take all of these cities back? Are they waiting to begin that attack? What's the status?
Actually, Fallujah is still under siege since days. The army already surrounded it, but the central government kept sending reinforcements to reinforce its troops there in the whole Anbar province. As they have a big military operation there, they have there's fighting in Eastern Ramadi, and in Fallujah they are expecting a big battle will erupt in any minute. But there is no fighting in Fallujah. Literally, there is no fighting in Fallujah, and even the shelling that was launched by the Iraqi army into the eastern and northern parts of Fallujah was stopped this morning as the tribal leaders in Ramadi and Fallujah made a deal with the central government to try to convince the militants to leave the city, the Fallujah, I mean, and in return, the army has not been allowed to enter the city and attack any of those militants inside the city. Otherwise, there will be another talks next few days. So right now, they are not planning to launch any offensive targeting Fallujah.
We've heard a lot about weapons coming in from outside, Russian helicopters to support the central government, U.S. arms, even Iranian arms, even potentially Iranian advisors. Where does that stand, Sawdad?
Actually, we have no evidence that Iranians involved so far, but we know that for sure Russian involved as they carried out the purchase that Iraq made last year and helicopters, Russian helicopters are effectively taking part in this in this battle this time. And just because of this, sounds like Iraqi troops are making great progress in the desert of Anbar and going after the Islamic State of Iraq and the Levant. They destroyed many big, very big camps in this desert, which Iraqi troops couldn't reach it since years, since the U.S. Troops left Iraq.
So, Sadat, Fallujah is only 40 miles from Baghdad, and here it is in the last few days taken over by al-Qaeda, essentially al-Qaeda in Iraq, as you say, fighters. Are people in Baghdad worried?
To be honest, no, they are not, because already it is not new and it was expected along the last few months. Al-Qaeda was showing up every time, sometimes every day, and they were carrying high-profile attacks and assaults on the local governments in Anbar, in Ramadi and Fallujah, and also in the towns, the small towns along the Iraqi-Syrian border. And everyone was expecting that it was a matter of time when they gonna to take control over these cities, as the government hadn't do anything to deal seriously with the situation and to treat it. It wasn't a big surprise when they took control over the city of Fallujah and the city of Ramadi. As we said, it looks like that they were just waiting for a suitable time to announce their control over these cities.
Sadat al-Salhi, Reuters correspondent in Baghdad, in Iraq. Thank you very much. Be safe. Thank you for being with us today.
Thank you very much for you.
Joining us now from New York is Ned Parker, former Los Angeles Times Baghdad bureau chief, now an independent reporter who's just returned from Iraq, where he spoke with many of the forces fighting in Anbar province. Ned Parker, welcome back to On Point. Great to have you here.
Great to be with you, Tom.
Can you explain what's going on in western Iraq in Anbar province, Fallujah, Ramadi?
Oh, that's the million-dollar question, isn't it? I think Suadad got to some great points about the situation. It's incredibly complex. The al-Qaeda was able to play upon the divisions of Iraq right now, the divisions between Prime Minister Nouri Maliki, the Shiite Islamist, and the Sunni population, particularly in provinces like Anbar, where protests have been going on for a year demanding greater rights regarding the issue of being isolated from Baghdad, harassed by security forces, having many relatives detained for years at a time without being charged in a court. Protests started about a year ago with encampments in the city of Ramadi, in the city of Fallujah, and likewise in other provinces around the country, including Baghdad. No real progress was made in resolving the issues. You couple that with the regional tensions that have been building due to the Sunni Islamist presence in Syria. And what you have in Iraq is a situation that was a ticking bomb where there had been no real national reconciliation over the years, including when the Americans were there, this kind of recent effort and frustration by Sunni tribes. And due to the stagnation and lack of a breakthrough, you could argue that both the government in Baghdad with the Prime Minister Maliki and the Sunni tribes themselves became more radicalized, used more sectarian rhetoric, and at the end of December, Maliki, who is facing a national election in April and is worried about his own Shiite competitors who would like to succeed him in the chair of prime minister, decided he needed to act because there has been this year, given the sectarian tensions in the region, given the lack of progress in Iraq and dealing with internal issues, there's been a huge terror campaign waged by al-Qaeda.
8,000 dead last year, I think the number was.
Yeah, it's devastating, horrible. I was visiting sites of bombings in Baghdad in November and December, and the anguish that people experience in these areas long after the bombing is huge. So Maliki, as any politician dealing with a terror campaign, had to deal with it. Now, how he did lacked subtlety, and one could argue played into perhaps the hands of al-Qaeda. I mean, time will tell. But he decided to act and act forcefully. So he equated the protest camps in Anbar with al-Qaeda. First, he started a campaign in the desert of Anbar against al-Qaeda. There was an operation at the end of the third week of December that was a complete catastrophe, where 24 officers were killed, including a commander of a division. After that, Maliki turned his sights on the protesters.
And these were protesters with legitimate grievances about what they call the heavy hand of Shiite-dominated rule out of Baghdad when they're mainly Sunni. I want to look at that and much more, if you'll hold that thought for a second. But, Ned, do you assume that these cities will go back to central government control, or could this be the beginning of a real rip in the fabric of the whole region beyond Syria, where it's already ripped along this Saudi-Iran fault line?
Right. Great question again. I think you could argue that the rip, the tear, has been there. It has been there over time. And the failure for these nations internally to resolve their problems allows, when there's regional tensions, for everything to explode. And that's what we're seeing now in Iraq. Now, the positive sign in the recent fighting in Anbar is that the Sunni tribes, the majority of them, have risen up against al-Qaeda. They do not want al-Qaeda.
Ned Parker, hold it right there if you would. We're talking about the battle for Fallujah again in a region-wide picture here. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point. The sound of gunfire there in Iraq between the Iraqi military and al-Qaeda militants in Anbar province on Sunday. We're talking this hour about the battle for Fallujah and more. Again, Iraq and a region in peril this time. Ned Parker is with us from New York, independent reporter, just returned from Iraq, where he talked with a lot of the forces fighting in Anbar province. There was a time when Americans were glad to leave and, wished the best for Iraq. Here was President Obama, October 21st, 2011, announcing that the last 40,000 troops would be out of Iraq as scheduled by the end of that year.
Today, I can report that, as promised, the rest of our troops in Iraq will come home by the end of the year. After nearly 9 years, America's war in Iraq will be over. Over the next 2 months, our troops in Iraq, tens of thousands of them, will pack up their gear and board convoys for the journey home.
And out they came. By December of last year, just a couple years later, former Iraqi National Security Advisor Dr. Mowafaq al-Rubai said the violence in Iraq will continue to escalate. He's talking here with the BBC.
The level of violence now is back to the level of violence at the end of 2007, unfortunately, and beginning of 2008. I think it will get worse before it starts getting better. I believe al-Qaeda is trying very hard to target the civilian Shia community to attract the Shia militia to respond and to trigger off a sectarian war.
Well, they have some version of that, and it extends well beyond Iraq. You can see big elements of it in Syria. You can see it in Lebanon, and you can see it now right into Anbar province. On Sunday, Secretary of State John Kerry promised to help Iraq battle the al-Qaeda-linked militants who've taken over parts of Ramadi and most of Fallujah, but he confirmed no American troops would be deployed.
This is a fight that belongs to the Iraqis. That is exactly what the president and the world decided some time ago when we left Iraq. So we are not, obviously, contemplating returning. We're not contemplating putting boots on the ground. This is their fight. But we're going to help them in their fight.
Former Los Angeles Times Baghdad Bureau Chief Ned Parker joins us today from New York. And from London, Roger Cohen joins us. New York Times op-ed columnist, former longtime foreign correspondent, foreign editor. Roger Cohen, welcome back to On Point. Thank you for being here.
Thank you, Tom.
Some of your colleagues at the Times, reporter colleagues, have looked at this over the weekend and said, we've got a whole region here coming undone in a power vacuum created by, more or less, the withdrawal of American boots on the ground and influence, and with potentially region-wide, almost at this point, incalculable consequences. What do you see going on here, Roger?
Well, Tom, I think nothing loves a vacuum like a jihadi group, and it was clear in northern Syria, more than 3 years now into the war, that there was just no longer any appetite in the United States or in any other Western democracy to do anything to fill the vacuum there. The Syrian war began slowly. After the first year, there were only a matter of a few thousand refugees. But nothing was done. It was allowed to escalate. And what had become a rebellion against Assad in Syria turned into something involving a whole variety of jihadi groups who now more or less control that area. And the lesson, I think, was clear in Iraq. And now we are seeing this rapid escalation in what's essentially a lawless area of Western Iraq, combined with what's going on in Syria. And it's very ominous. There is no appetite. There is still no appetite for doing anything. And we know from Afghanistan, we know from the very beginning before 9/11, that when you get a large area that is essentially uncontrolled and that becomes a haven or refuge for the most extreme jihadis, the danger is real. And I think at a time when we're still discussing what kind of deal for a residual presence in Afghanistan the United States is going to make, if any, remember, we were going to stay on in some form in Iraq before efforts to reach an agreement failed. I think the lesson is pretty clear that it is important not to simply cut and leave.
But can it be, Roger, that, you know, any place that doesn't have American boots on the ground or drones firing down from overhead is by definition a vacuum? I mean, a lot of Americans thought, you know, we shouldn't be there in the first place. And so our absence makes a vacuum. Why not just, I don't know, that's the natural state, or that's just reality. That's just the U.S.
Well, Tom,
gone home.
I think the balance of power, it's a turbulent region to begin with, but the balance of power such as it was upset by moving into Iraq in the war of 2003 and essentially moving control of that country from the Sunnis to the Shia. This was never accepted or digested by the Saudis, and therein you have the germ of this escalating Sunni-Shia conflict, which is posing real questions about Sykes-Picot, about the borders that were drawn on the map after the collapse of the Ottoman Empire after World War I. And a lot of those borders, you know, be they between Lebanon and Syria or now between Syria and Iraq, they're still there on the map, but they look less and less meaningful. I think you're beginning to see a realignment of interests, power throughout the region. And one big question we haven't talked about is the ongoing negotiations between the United States and Iran, where, as we reported today in a piece, I think, by Thomas Erdbrink, you know, clearly our interests and Iranian interests, whether in reaching some settlement in Syria or heading off any kind of extreme violence in Iraq that could unseat the government, you know, those interests are beginning to align more and more, and you could get some new balance of power emerging through that. But you have fierce resistance, whether from Israel or from the Saudis, in Congress, from others, to that. So I think you're in a, and you have the Arab Spring in the background. So you have a moment of extreme flux and extreme uncertainty, with as the backdrop a deep unwillingness after a decade of war of the United States or any of the Western powers to get involved in any bigger way.
Ned Parker, the number of things in motion here is kind of mind-boggling. Of course, you had Sunnis in charge in Iraq for such a long time and under Saddam Hussein, now Shia, and the Sunni there feeling stepped on, inspired in part by the Arab Spring to put up these protest camps you described, Ned, in Fallujah, Ramadi. And now just a potential proxy war in a way between Iran and the Saudis, the U.S. out. Can we just help us look at this piece, Ned? The militant jihadis in Fallujah and Ramadi, in Fallujah just 40 miles from Baghdad, say they are establishing, or they dream of establishing, but there they are with their guns, this Islamic new caliphate there. Never mind the borders that are on the map right now, they're saying. We want an Islamist state that sits across the Syrian and Iraqi borders, takes in Anbar province and a big chunk of Syria. That sounded like very fanciful not long ago. Is it still fanciful today, Ned?
Well, the danger is the chaos. The idea of vacuums, as both of you were referring to, there is a vacuum now on the Syrian border and on the Iraqi side, in Anbar and also in Nineveh province to the north. We have Nineveh, which is the capital is Mosul, is basically under Qaeda control. As long as you have chaos, you have the void and the vacuum where people can operate, where radical groups can operate.
And all of this bordering Syria, of course, where there's real chaos.
Exactly. And it doesn't take much. I mean, basically, to have like a terror training camp or compound, you just need a backyard or a few acres, which also points out the fact that you can never really control or get rid of hardliners. And this is also a matter of a proxy war. So I think the reality we're seeing in places like Syria and Iraq is likely to be areas where there's a breakdown of rule of law or of the civilian government, potential proxy money coming from Gulf sheikhs or other parties and groups that are able to move. Now, the silver lining in what's going on now, if there is one, is clearly there's a limit to how much people will stomach or tolerate extremism. We can see that now on the Syrian side of the border where mm-hmm. there's a fight between the Al-Qaeda affiliates and other Islamists. And really, when we're looking at Iraq right now, what's quite interesting is, I mean, this crisis started really when the prime minister ordered the clearing of the protest camp in Ramadi of
right.
Mainstream Sunni tribal figures, mm-hmm. Who definitely have sectarian strains, but still, you know, protesting for aspirational things. So the tribes rose up against Maliki. He ordered his troops out of Fallujah and Ramadi, and Al-Qaeda tried to exploit that. Once they did, the mainstream tribes of Anbar started to fight Al-Qaeda. So that shows there's a clear limit. Likewise, in 2007, when the U.S. surge started, one of the reasons it was successful was because at the end of the day, most people do not want to live under that yoke. And that's what happened then.
That is the yoke of Al-Qaeda in that day, even the Sunni tribal chiefs in that area. But that whole thing, the Arab awakening that David Petraeus helped get going, that helped make the surge ultimately successful, or at least at that time successful, the Americans were paying these sheikhs. The central government in Baghdad has not done that. They've alienated them. Is it clear that they will still ultimately turn toward Baghdad's central authority and the secular dream of a whole undivided Iraq here, Ned, rather than tip the other way?
Right. There are a lot of issues there. When the awakening started, it was first a natural reaction by the tribes
yep.
of Iraq, and General Petraeus was smart enough to capitalize on
mm-hmm.
it and fund it. But it first started within the Sunni community,
yep.
organically. But then you get into this question of, is it possible to have a secular Iraq or an Iraq where different communities can live together? Can these boundaries that were carved out at the end of World War I of modern Arab national states, can they continue to thrive in the 21st century? And it's such a huge question. I think that most Sunni Iraqis see themselves as part of Iraq the way that Shia do. As do most Syrians, there's an idea of a national identity and there's a competing sectarian identity. Both hold people within thrall. And in times of extremism, it's very easy to kind of fall into the fantasy of a greater communal identity. But people do see themselves as Iraqi as they do see themselves as Syrian. The challenge is to find ways to resolve these core issues inside the communities of how to live together, how they can live together within a state. And in Iraq, the failure of the Maliki government or of the Iraqi government since 2008, let's say, is the Prime Minister Maliki and those around him weren't able to find a way, once you had the Sunni awakening, to truly reconcile with the Sunni community, to bring them to the table after they had lost power with the fall of Saddam.
Roger
if
Cohen,
they could solve that, then you could get somewhere.
That would be huge in Iraq, but it's a region-wide picture. Roger, take us back to the proxy dynamics of this, that this, it, through one very large lens, is a competition between Saudi Arabia and Iran, between Sunni and Shia writ large across the whole region, from Lebanon to Syria, now in Iraq. I mean, that is driving and fueling. That's putting arms in here. It's putting money in here. Describe the strategic standoff that these two countries see in their current competition.
Well, I think it's a very deep rivalry, and I don't see any easy way to stem it. The Saudis are furious. I mean, they have criticized the United States in recent months and refused to take up their position on the UN Security Council in ways that we've not seen before from the Saudis. And there's no question that they have their own agenda now in the Middle East, which they are pursuing vigorously.
What is it?
And, they are understandably, I think, angry over Syrian policy, in that President Obama very early on said that President Assad must go, and that this was a goal of U.S. policy and would be relatively quickly accomplished. Instead of which, nothing happened, in essence. And a war that I think could have been stemmed pretty early on was allowed to... I really think that Syria is the key here, because it has become the nexus, the kernel, the venue where the Iranian-Saudi-Sunni-Shia rivalry is playing out before our eyes. And as Ned was suggesting, the only answer is to grow the idea of nationality and citizenship and shrink the idea of sectarian identity. But what we're seeing throughout the region, if anything, is the opposite. We had the complete failure. I think the coup was a huge mistake, but we had the failure of President Morsi in Egypt to reach beyond the Brotherhood, again, to reach beyond the sectarian identity into an Egyptian identity, which included the Coptic Christians and the other citizens of Egypt. Obviously, Assad has never even tried. He just viewed the country as his own personal fiefdom. And Prime Minister Maliki, similarly, in Iraq, has failed in that quest. Now, how... Because as Ned said again, that this idea does exist, I think, across sectarian identities of the national state, but it is in shrunken mode, and the funding coming out of Tehran and Riyadh at the moment in this proxy war, as you said, Tom, is doing nothing to help in that quest.
But isn't Al-Qaeda? I mean, Al-Qaeda was founded in part to take the Saudi royal family out of Saudi Arabia, and now Saudi Arabia ends up willy-nilly lining up with it?
Well, I don't think, you know, I mean, these things are very messy in the Middle East. I don't think that is the, certainly not, the Saudi aim. It was trying to back other Sunni groups, the initial Free Syrian Army and
yes,
other groups in Syria. But, you know, the net result, as you've just indicated, is this, you know, kind of hallucinogenic situation. I mean, we know it ourselves. I mean, who funded the Mujahideen in Afghanistan? We, the United States, did. And, you know, what happened when we took our eyes off the ball? Well, you know, a boomerang that, you know, slowly led all the way to 9/11. And you have all kinds of unintended consequences. But, you know, the Saudi anger is real. I think we're at a very, very critical moment, Tom, in this whole negotiation with Iran. That is a game changer. If the United States and Iran have, it doesn't have to be a warm relationship, and it won't be, but if we have a relationship, if conceivably as Secretary of State Kerry...
Roger, hold the thought. We're up against the break right here. We'll come back and look at that and more. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point. We're talking this hour with the battle for Fallujah again, Iraq, and a region in peril. Video released there by the Global Islamic Media Front, the sound you hear behind me, underground media organization. It is associated with Al-Qaeda. Militants there firing at the Iraqi military. We remember video like this coming out when American troops were there. It's well beyond that time now, but fighting in Fallujah, in Ramadi, Al-Qaeda-linked groups, more than linked, in charge in Fallujah in recent days. It is some kind of picture, 2 years after American troops out of Iraq. The fighting, not just in Iraq, of course, sectarian chaos all over the place. Shia divide, Sunni divide. Here's Beirut, Lebanon, in the chaotic aftermath of an explosion there last Thursday. Lots of fronts on this, and no clear boundaries around the fighting right now. Roger Cohen, you say this may all hinge on the U.S. and Iran and what they work out. What do you mean by that?
You know, I think we have a new Middle East. Whatever else we have a new Middle East emerging. The U.S. relationship with this new Middle East is also different. Apart from anything, the U.S. is going to be self-sufficient in energy less than a decade from now. The relationship with the Saudis, with the Gulf monarchies, is going to change because of that. And I think we have to think of a new architecture, new security architecture for the region. I think the non-relationship, the psychotic, often non-relationship between the United States and what has been, in effect, one of the most stable major powers in the region, Iran, with all the caveats that exist about the Islamic Republic, that is a potential game changer with the relatively moderate government now of President Rouhani. Now, right now in Congress, of course, there are many members of Congress who are trying to derail this with new sanctions against Iran and so on. We know how angry Prime Minister Netanyahu is in Israel. But if you look at Afghanistan, if you look at Iraq, if you look at Syria, and imagine, you know, instead of hostility, even minimal cooperation between the United States and Iran in trying, for example, to coax Assad toward the exit. He has to go. There's no peace in Syria conceivable after what has happened, as long as the Assad family, which has controlled Syria for 42 years, is still there. If he's going to be coaxed toward it, you need the Russians, you need Iran, you need, obviously, the United States and its European allies. And I do think this is a very important element that's in play right now, and how it comes out will have, if the U.S. and Iran, if all this effort just collapses, I think that will be very ominous.
But, Roger, I don't get how, okay, the U.S., let's say, works out some arrangements with Iran. Fine, but Saudi Arabia is watching all this. If they see this as some kind of region-wide existential conflict with Iran, they can fuel conflict going on and on as well. We may be more energy independent, but China's going to buy Saudi oil. They're going to have a lot of money. They can pour it wherever they want. Mm-hmm. If they define this as a Iran versus Saudi, Shia versus Sunni thing that they're not going to surrender in, how does the U.S. reaching some accommodation with Iran fix that? Or is something that takes Assad out enough?
Tom, I think, first of all, the Saudis are ultimately still dependent on U.S. support. The Saudis want to know that we have their backs. I mean, they are, of course, very rich and well-armed, but without the U.S. security umbrella, they are going to feel insecure.
But how do we have their backs if we're allied with Iran?
I don't think they'll shoot themselves in the foot. If you take Syria, if there is a deal, what do they want, the Saudis? They want Assad out. And because the Sunnis are a majority in Syria, their assumption is that, much like in Iraq, once Saddam Hussein was gone, the Shia majority came to power in the person of Maliki now. They no doubt think that similarly, if there's anything resembling a democratic process in Syria post-Assad, this will produce some kind of Sunni-dominated government. That is something they would want, so they can... You know, I could see a situation where they would hold back on the kind of activity you just described, and there's been a lot of it, and not just there. It happened in Egypt, too.
Yeah, but meanwhile, we've got Sunnis in Iraq, which is now almost Iran's client state. Iran can't feel too good about that. Syria, major ally to Iran, and if Assad goes and it goes Sunni, hard to picture that relationship going on in a positive way. Hard to imagine Tehran really going for that. Kevin in Randolph, Massachusetts is calling. Hi, Kevin, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
As regards Iraq, I have to say, if anything, I'm surprised that it took this long for this to happen. whatever anyone feels about the wisdom of making of that invasion, the post-invasion planning was horrendous. We didn't listen to General Shinseki and send in 500,000 troops. We disbanded the military. We disbanded the police. And everything that happened subsequent to that invasion was because of that poor planning. And we'll never know what would have happened if we had done things properly.
Kevin, John McCain says we shouldn't have pulled out 2 years ago. We should still have troops in there. Joe Biden didn't cut a good deal, and this rolls out of that. What do you say to it?
Well, I say that the things that happened were because of the poor planning. We might have been able to
earlier,
years if we had had a stable Iraq post-invasion by putting in enough people, by leaving their military in place. A lot of the things that happened in that country would not have happened if we had the presence to prevent it from happening. So now the hatred and the vitriol that exists, which is probably normal between the different clans and the different sects, but all the things that happened in 2004 and 2005 and 2006 might not have happened. And it might have made it a much more peaceful country.
We're pushing arms in there urgently right now to help Maliki. Do you think that is that the right role for the U.S., Kevin?
No, I think my point is that it's all too late. What happened as a result of the poor planning is what happened, and we can't undo it. And this is going to play itself out, whether we like it or not, because of
The way it began.
Plan.
Yeah, I hear it. Kevin, thank you for that. Ned Parker, here's a tweet from Jamie Terabay, who was NPR's Baghdad bureau chief. In the thick of a lot of this. And she's tweeted, unfortunately, not surprised by chatter that Washington should have armed Maliki. But she says, does anyone really believe he'll use weapons on Al-Qaeda only? The suggestion there, Ned Parker, that if we go in and arm up further Maliki to deal with its crisis in Anbar province right now, he'll turn around and use that to sit on all the Sunni, not just the jihadi militants making a lot of noise right now, Ned.
Well, I think Jamie's assessment is a very sound one. It's a danger. And look at how this started. It began with Maliki sending troops in to clear out protesters with legitimate demands.
Yeah.
And this is right before an election that he's worried about losing. And if there's a crisis in Sunni areas where he is seen as defending the Shia, the majority Shia population, because they are so afraid, will stand behind him. And it'll also make it harder for his Shiite political competitors to undermine him. So it is a problem. And I think it underscores this broader question of what does the U.S. need to do in Iraq? Is it a matter of having boots on the ground? Is that where America went wrong in Iraq by taking all the troops out in 2011? Or do we need to be doing – does America need to be doing something more? Does America, not just in Iraq, but in other places in the Middle East and perhaps in Afghanistan, need to be looking at how it engages on a diplomatic level?
Are going to hear that, Ned, and say, good Lord, do more. I mean, we've spent more than a decade in these countries with sort of full throttle engagement, and here we are. And you say, do more.
Well, I'm not saying troop engagement. I'm talking about diplomatic engagement. And I think the legitimate criticism of the Obama administration, if there is one about Iraq, would be in its failure to be engaged on a diplomatic level. You could have had troops on the ground in Iraq after 2011 and have the very same danger now, which would be U.S. advisors helping Maliki and his counterterrorism forces hitting a Sunni population where many of them were not involved in any violence. So that would have been bad for America's interests. The question is, how do you create a sound policy to help promote real issues of nation building? And that's not about troops on the ground, but that's about soft power, diplomatic engagement.
Yeah, I want to ask you about a couple of things here. First of all, do you think that it's possible that all this, which looks so frightening right now, could be self-staunching, self-limiting? Already in Syria, as you pointed out, those less Islamist-oriented opposition troops to Assad are fighting with these uber jihadis right now. You've got tribal leaders in Anbar province who don't want to be under al-Qaeda rule. Could this just work itself out? And I also want to ask you about Roger Cohen's notion that if the U.S. cuts some kind of deal with Iran, this might all be staunched in that way. Do you see that, Ned? And how would Saudi Arabia live with that?
Great questions. Regarding the staunching, I think you're going to have in Iraq and Syria very different problems, different internal dynamics. But until you find a deal on governance or on a way to stabilize the situation beyond the short-term fighting, you're just going to have a new permutation of the troubles now. So al-Maliki could, the tribes could defeat al-Qaeda in Anbar province, but you're still going to have the core dispute with the prime minister then. And also internal tribal rivalries in Anbar, where one tribe will try to get Maliki to come in and the U.S. Implicitly to go in and kill their rivals. And there's probably some similar dynamic like that that could happen in Syria, where you have Islamists fighting al-Qaeda and then fighting each other. So at the end of the day, you get to this core issue of how do you resolve the long-term problems of governance, a social contract. Regarding a deal between the U.S. and Iran and how Saudi Arabia would respond, I think Roger's right on the money that this is huge. It could help stabilize the region. But the reasons for that and I think are this about matters of pragmatism, survival of the nation. And when you look at for Iran and ultimately why Saudi Arabia would accept a deal between the U.S. and Iran is because its immediate interest is its domestic constituency in having a prosperous, stable nation. We talk about a regional war right now. Iran and Saudi Arabia are seen as giants, moving these chess pieces on the board. But really, up close, they're sickly giants. They both have huge young populations, not enough jobs for them, questions of long-term succession, whether what happens after Khamenei in Iran or what happens in Saudi Arabia with the monarchy. So these regional wars are costly. And within Iran, I think there has been a private debate internally about what Syria is. Is Syria Iran's Vietnam? So for that reason alone, they want to have a stable region. They might be a giant, but they are a weak giant. So stability is in everyone's interest.
That sounds like an opportunity for something more stable, but who knows which way it goes. Kyle in Madison, Wisconsin. Kyle, thanks. You're on the air.
Hey, Tom. Hey, one of the points that I want to bring up, and you guys were talking about the fighting in Fallujah, and I had done some work in contracting work in Iraq, and what I saw when we left and all the troops pulled out, we did not leave the Iraqi military with much to work with. I mean, from what I saw, they are probably fighting Al-Qaeda on a one-to-one level. The only helicopters I saw that they had were them old Russian ones, the big ones, that you really can't go in and fight with, because you'll get shot down with a surface-to-air missile.
Yeah.
And, I read, because I was there, I kind of follow the papers, what's going on.
Sure.
And it seems to me that the United States is reluctant to arm the Iraqis. They're trying to buy arms from Russia.
And even Iran. Kyle, I'm glad you raised it. Our time is short. Ned, I'll bring that to you, and then Roger, come to you. But, Ned, what about the strength of the Iraqi army? Can they contain this? I mean, it was a full-on fight for the U.S. military to get back into Fallujah at great cost and get it back under control. Can the Iraqis do this, Ned?
I think you could argue that the Iraqi security forces are a mirror to the deeply dysfunctional state of Iraq itself. One, it's the force, not intentionally, but it comes off as sectarian because of the high Shiite component. Two, the force has been accused credibly with by allegations of rights abuses against general populations. They don't do counterinsurgency well. And then three, there's so much corruption within the Iraqi security forces that too prevents it from being a very strong functioning fighting force. I heard from several Iraqi officials when I was in Iraq, and there was even a public comment about it by Amar Hakim, who's a leader of one of the main Shiite religious parties. But at this point, senior command positions within the ISF are for sale to the highest bidder. Not all, but a sizable number. So that just shows you there are no easy answers here. It's messy.
Roger Cohen, where does this – it looks like an unraveling in the last few days. Now, maybe it turns around. Maybe it stops. People have interest. But where do you see this, I don't know, zipper, stop unzipping? And if it's U.S. engagement that's going to do it – what's the weight behind that engagement? There aren't troops there. We have sway, but a lot of other interests are at work here, too.
Well, I think Ned's point about intensified diplomacy is a very valid one. We're convening maybe a conference on Syria now, and maybe down the road we want one on Iraq. I, I think there's an almost psychological issue here. Iraq is a terrible memory for the United States. It's a trauma, and it's something I think as a nation we're trying furiously to forget. Trillions of dollars went in there, and it was a bungled operation and initiated on false grounds. And it's a very, very painful memory, analogous to Vietnam in the immediate aftermath. I think we have to get over that trauma in order to take a hard look at Iraq and be prepared to invest, not putting boots on the ground, but invest serious resources in trying to overcome the widening sectarian splits within Iraq and ensure that the kind of venal policies and extreme corruption doesn't become even more rampant. And certainly we do not want Iraq to turn into a failed state or to turn into something resembling Syria. So that requires focus, and focus requires getting over the trauma.
Roger Cohen in London, op-ed columnist for the New York Times. Roger, thank you very much for being with us again today.
Thank you, Tom.
And Ned Parker with us from New York. Ned, thank you very much for your insights today.
Thanks, Tom.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR.